Ghosts in the Attic, Bodies in the Basement is a paranormal true crime podcast.
If you enjoy tales of horror, lore, and the unexplained,
murders, mystery, and so much more,
tune into our bi-weekly podcast.
With us, your hosts, Anna Temperley
and Lindsay Behe, coming March 17th
through the Fearscape Media Podcast Network.
Available on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever else you may listen to your podcasts.
There is no question that something is here, lurking somewhere in the darkened corners. But how will we ever find out what it is? We need to look, always, and never stop. No matter what stands in our way, no matter what others may think. Explore the darkness. Shine light into it. Join the red strings and the silver threads. Everything is connected, somehow. I am Mark L. Watson. This is Peer Beyond the Veil.
I kind of think that this sort of subject matter finds you more than you finding it. You know, I mean, you don't get into writing about this stuff for the money or for the fame, and most of your personal relationships, they think that you're kind of a little bit nutty for doing it. So, I'd always had an interest in this sort of thing. As I've said before, I was a real, real monster creature feature kind of kid, right? So if it had a monster in the movie, like, I was all about it, you know. Those old Ray Harryhausen films and anything involving, you know, practical effects with aliens and monsters, and just always about it. So I think it probably was part of where it started from. Not much of a UFO interest early in my life, but definitely a huge Bigfoot interest. Which ironically, I didn't really write a ton about Bigfoot until recently either, but so I was sort of, you know, peripherally involved or peripherally interested in this stuff. You know, just had a handful of books. I think the book that I keep on going to as my touchstone was Jerome Clark's The Unexplained. And if you look at my copy that's still at my parents' place, it's been covered with masking tape because the cover kept on falling off and my mom kept on having to repair it. And, you know, now here I am, you know, 25 years later, and Jerome Clark's favorably talking about me. It's like this weird place to be. But so around 2012, I got an office job working at the University of Georgia, and it was about an hour commute between there and where I was living once my wife and I moved in together. So obviously, you know, podcasts, right? That's your opportunity to listen to podcasts. So I started really getting into listening to podcasts and paranormal podcasts. And starting to get back into the paranormal. And around that same time, maybe a couple of years later, my sisters-in-law gave me an Amazon gift card and told me to go buy something that I wanted. So I was, you know, I bought myself a Bigfoot book. I bought myself J. Robert Alley's Raincoast Sasquatch, and I was reading it. And I remember reading this portion of the book where they're talking about the, you know, the Native American analogs to Bigfoot in that part of the country, which is the southern coast of Alaska. And they mentioned that the Bookwus, which was one version of Bigfoot, would offer people, you know, this supposed food that was salmon, but it was actually, you know, cloaked dried bark of a tree, but they cloaked it to make it look like it was salmon. And if you ate the food from this Sasquatch character, you were trapped with them forever. And I was like, huh. You know, and I always knew that that was sort of like a thing with you know, Western European fairy folklore. If, you know, if you eat it, you'd be trapped forever. And I said, that's really interesting. Somebody should write a book about that sometime. And I waited and I waited and I said, oh, is that me? So I ended up over the course of a summer at my university job, this kind of scandalous now, I guess, but I mostly worked on my book that summer because at the university, a lot of the workload slowed down for me. So I wrote a lot of the book there. And it was one of those things where A Trojan Feast was released in May of 2015. And I turned in my resignation like July of 2015 or something like that. Cause it was just the work situation was not super fun. As a lot of people who are staff in academia can tell you. I wasn't playing as much music as I wanted to be. And, you know, it's a book about UFOs and Bigfoot, you know, kind of have sullied your name. And I'm pretty sure because before I just said, I'm going to quit and do freelancing and writing, I had applied to some other jobs, in the Southeast here. And I'm pretty sure that I got to the, you know, the next to last tier before I was hired and they finally decided to Google me. And that's when they found out about me being a nutter, right?
Since the times before Buddhism spread across the tribes of the East, its influences climbing the highest peaks of the Himalayas, reaching those shamanic mountain peoples who occupied the remotest of villages, the legend of the Meitei, or the Yeti, has long existed. Known to the people there as the Mai Gu, the Wild Man, he was no folktale. In the 1920s, he came to the attention of British explorers and mountaineers, his footprints found on the highest slopes of Everest, inexplicably large in a place where no other man nor beast could roam. Charles Howard Berry of the British Reconnaissance Expedition to the area gave him the now infamous name, somewhat a corruption of a Nepalese translation, the Abominable Snowman. As word of the Wild Man of the Snow reached home, so too did his reputation. It would be three more decades before strange, huge footprints were found in Northern California, and the legend of the Meitei's distant cousin took on the form of Bigfoot. Many believe that the two creatures are of the same evolutionary branch of the great tree of life, their size and profile, their hair color and behavior altering slightly to their habitation. Wildman myths and legends exist across cultures. The Aran Pendek hides in the forests of Indonesia, the Almasti, his cousin in Mongolia. In Slavic folklore, there are tales of the Leshi. The shepherds of northern Pakistan tell of the Barmanu, and the Grey Man haunts the highest peaks of the Scottish Cairngorms. But as yet, no man has stepped forward with irrefutable proof of the existence of any of them. We have no body, no hair, no teeth, no scat, no photograph which is deemed inarguable. So could they possibly exist on this tiny rock of ours with us and entirely invade any capture or cataloguing? Perhaps. Such a thing's not entirely impossible. But, perhaps, there's another explanation. Perhaps they exist here with us, but in a way which differs from ours. Should they be able to come and go from our reality, for example, show themselves whenever they choose, however they choose, then perhaps they are here all the time, and what we catch is the merest glimpse behind the curtain. Such theories are wild and varied. They're spirits, they're extraterrestrials, they're ultra-terrestrials. We, of course, have no real way to know. Yet. The evidence for all of the above is present, but we're yet to gather enough evidence of any of them for us all to land in the same place on such things. My guest tonight is rapidly changing that. A researcher and author on various aspects of the paranormal spectrum, he's penned two of the finest and most well-researched compendiums of knowledge on the Bigfoot phenomenon. Meticulous in detail and with the great ability to unearth and analyze the variety of theories which abound, it's with great pleasure that we welcome the fantastic Joshua Cutchin to the show tonight to share some of his work and to explain how, if we're going to get to the bottom of Bigfoot, then we all need to peer beyond the veil.
Part of what I really like about this, the paranormal, supernatural, whatever you want to call it, is that you kind of end up bringing all aspects of life into it, you know, art and science and you know, literature and it just all psychology, all these different things. Sort of, this is sort of like a sort of the, maybe it's the hub of the wheel almost. Sometimes I wonder that if this yeah. is just isn't where all these things lead to. It's really interesting. I noticed something a couple of years ago, back when I was just doing the, you know, the classically trained music thing in college. I always used to have friends who were atheists and, you know, never been an atheist, but I would always notice that it was kind of like the atheists were always the smartest and most well-read person in the room. And I was like, wow, what does that mean? And now, you know, 10, 12 years later, it's always the occultists who are the most read and smartest people in the room, I've noticed. You know, the smartest people that I know are occultists. And though that's not my particular, you know, spiritual path either. Yeah, just the breadth of knowledge that a lot of these people exhibit is fantastic. And I'll say something else. You know, people like to sort of wax on about the backstabbing and the petty infighting and the paranormal. And yeah, I think that just happens really everywhere. I will say that by and large, and I've talked about this with Timothy when we both were on our way back from one of these conferences, the people who are involved and who are fans and who are, you know, producers in the paranormal, you know, be it films or books or just lectures or whatever, are 1,000 times nicer and more genuine than in the music industry. Like, it's not even comparable. I get the impression that there are a lot of people who are really earnestly looking for truth and not just cynics and grifters. Yeah,
I think there's a respect, quite a widespread mutual respect for, we all recognize that, you know, we've all sat in groups of friends, family, in bars, in general settings in our societies where some of the things we talk about, you're mocked for, you are judged for at the very least, and sometimes worse. And so I find just this acceptance that we're all in this for essentially similar reasons. And there has been just, I felt for myself, and I can only speak for myself, so much love and warmth from people, because it feels like we're all in this kind of little place together. And sometimes we can feel like there aren't many of us here, but and actually wider society doesn't accept some of the things we want to talk about. And
well, I think there's a real valuing of the subjective in these paranormal fields, you know? I mean, how did this make you feel? Did you get a sense of this? Did you, you know, I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk now about, you know, personal truths and lived experiences, but that's definitely the case when we're talking about these things. I mean, some of the experiences, some of the emotions that people have had, I should never be somebody to say that it didn't happen to them in some of these experiences that they've shared with me. And I think that in and of itself is an humbling experience, really. Thieves in the Night, a brief history of supernatural child abduction, I believe is the subtitle. I always have to remind myself of it. Was motivated by a couple of different things. I had not written about fairy folklore since the Trojan Feast, really. I wanted to do something with fairy folklore. I kind of wanted to write a book that was actually unsettling and scary. Supernatural child abduction is kind of about as scary as it gets, I think, especially as a parent now. And I also sort of wanted to put together a one-stop shop of changeling folklore. So there really wasn't a book that was sort of a collection of changeling folklore from all around the world. There is an out-of-print German text called Der Wechselbalg. That things are like 5 copies or something. So that was part of it too. And then part of it also was, you know, I like to write and challenge my worldviews. And since I'm firmly ensconced in the worldview that the alien contact experience, whatever that is, and a lot of this fairy lore, especially Western European fairy lore from all around the world, I'm pretty much convinced that they're describing the same thing. I don't think aliens are fairies. I don't think fairies are aliens. But I think they're all describing the same thing. So with that in mind, Josh, how do you nest the alien hybrid project, as it's become known in like a lot of these abduction circles, within the context of fairy folklore? And so that was, you know, learning experience for me as well, and it's sort of a challenge to myself. So that was the impetus for it.
One of the kind of underpinning themes of really all your work, certainly of that book, and obviously Where the Footprints End, and a theme that I think probably is attributed to you, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that a lot of these phenomena are linked. And so you've got the Fae lore and the extraterrestrial topic, for whatever that is, linked. But coming into that is a cryptid element, which very specifically relates to Bigfoot, but obviously to others. And then also, which isn't necessarily something I've encountered too much in your work, but it is when you speak with other people, they will bring in actually the supernatural ghost element. I don't want to call it the ghost element, but that contact experience is also related, and that actually, while it may be a multi-branched or a multi-limbed branch that runs through it, it is indeed still just one branch.
I think it's an accurate assessment, really. I mean, of a lot of the way that I feel. I've said I'm not sure if this is all the same thing, but the Venn diagrams have significant portions in which they overlap. Now, whether or not that means it's all the same thing or it's different things using similar mechanisms, which sometimes I think that's the case, because the real universal constant is consciousness. I don't know. But when you hear stories about, a good example, this buzzing sound that happens. There's a buzzing sound that John Mack noted tended to kick off a lot of these experiences that a lot of this alien abductees experienced, right? Before they would have the experience, they'd notice this buzzing sound, like a bunch of bees. And, you know, some fairy abductees, famously Anne Jeffries, said that before she was whisked away to fairyland, she heard a sound as if it was 1,000 flies around her. People who take certain, not all, can't really generalize too much, but certain psychedelic substances will notice this sort of buzzing sound as well. This buzzing sound appears before some Bigfoot encounters, for Pete's sake. Now, of course, you've also got the Oz factor, which, you know, is where all the sounds go away. But still, you have this recurring idea of this buzzing sound facilitating an encounter. What does that mean? I don't know. But that's an awfully specific thing. You know, the description of the sound and the placement of the sound at the encounter, it's an awfully specific thing to suggest that it's all, you know, coincidence. What I'm sort of starting to discover on this journey of mine is that there are certain motifs that mankind has always attributed to the supernatural. And whatever the boogeyman du jour of their particular culture, they'll just sort of offload all those aspects onto it. So if, you know, a culture is obsessed with the restless dead, they'll say, oh yeah, missing time, and they'll put things in your body, and they'll abduct you. And then if it's fairies, the same thing. If it's aliens, the same thing. And to some degree, Bigfoot, the same thing. You know, one of my favorite Bigfoot connections is, you know, they braid horses' manes, which is the exact same thing that you can find in, you know, 17th century writings from Devon, for Pete's sake. You know, it's saying, oh no, well, you know, the fairies or the witches were braiding horses' manes to use as stirrups. So I find that interesting, even if it's not, you know, the horse's manes example is something that could very well be people just not brushing out their horse's manes. But still, I find it interesting that the attribution is to something paranormal or supernatural. And I've said on a couple of different occasions that it's not even like if any individual encounter or story is, you know, 100% true. It's the fact that you'll have people who, you know, in gestalt will describe the same thing separated by vast amounts of time and space. And I think that's the similarities that really compel me in taking a look at this stuff. So the why children question is something that I've thought about a good bit. I mean, you know, if you look at something like the fictional story, was it Arthur C. Clarke? It was Arthur C. Clarke. Childhood's End. Now I said Arthur C. Clarke, and now I've got to double check. You know, part of the goal of the aliens in that was to sort of use young human minds because they were the most malleable. And there's some science that's out there to suggest that young people have greater neuroplasticity. But if you're looking at this from a spiritual angle, you know, kids are just fresher souls. And for the, you know, in a lot of different cultures, they are perceived as just having crossed over from the other side into our world. So they kind of have one foot in that and one foot in the other. Even Jung thought that kids might be more connected to the collective unconscious because they sort of had just emerged from that soup themselves. So I wonder if it's something like that. I don't know. But yeah, you do see these connective things cropping up time and again. I mean, you mentioned the nighttime angle. Even if you don't take psychedelics, you experience an altered state of consciousness, you know, once a day, which is, you know, during sleep. And I think it's no coincidence that that's when a lot of these encounters take place. In case anybody's wondering about my thesis, I'm not saying that these things are in your head, but they might be, you know, from your head, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're very real, but they're pulling on stuff in your life and stuff in your head to sort of express themselves. So, but you know, the thing that I've been looking at a lot lately, as sort of a unifying motif is death. You know, even dreams are, you know, in a lot of cultures sort of, you know, the god or goddess of dreaming would be the brother or sister of the god or goddess of death. And if you think about, you know, all these paranormal things, they're always obsessed with the wheel of life, right? It's always sex or death and all these different encounters, you know. Fairies are taking people for sex or death, you know. Same thing with aliens, sex or death. So I kind of wonder if that's not, if literally the paranormal experience isn't, you know, like I said earlier, sort of like a birthright. If the paranormal experience literally is the human experience, I kind of wonder that sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we are certainly in the West, though largely everywhere, culturally shaped. And this actually also extends on to why children seem to be more open to some of these things. That if you look at children who have maybe past life memories or pre-life memories, by the ages of kind of 4, 5, 6, their memories can go. Even kids who've been frequently interviewed, who should really have formed memories of the memories, if that makes sense, will by the ages of 4, 5, 6, 7 completely forget these things. That actually culture, our society, expectation, whatever that might be, is playing a part on stopping you from believing, stopping you from remembering. That actually, as you say, maybe it's what we're all supposed to do. If you talk to a psychic, they'll tell you, we can all do it. It's within the capacity of a human to do these things, to experience these things, to have certain abilities. But you just, we just train ourselves out of it.
No, I think that's a really good point. You know, I'm not necessarily someone who ascribes to the idea that fluoride is put into our water specifically to calcify our pineal gland or something like that. But that as a metaphor, I think is absolutely spot on and on the nose. And I don't know if it's a concerted effort or it's just sort of a natural epiphenomena of our technological growth. You know, I've often, well, not often said, but I've speculated that, you know, people think that, you know, the US government is hiding all this knowledge of extraterrestrial intervention. And I am not a big extraterrestrial hypothesis person. If you're familiar with my work, that's not my thing. But you know, I think sometimes that, I mean, what would be more dramatic and more disruptive to control systems? The idea that there are extraterrestrials who are coming down here, or the idea that you are immortal and they have no power to punish you with, even with ending your life isn't a punishment because you keep on? Like, that's the real thing that upends the control system, right? And I can see, you know, the US government, or, you know, any amount of, you know, people in power realizing that there's good data for that. And they're like, oh, we can't let people know this because, you know, at the end of the day, every control system is predicated on physical violence, right? Even parking tickets, theoretically, you know, you could extend that idea out to the idea that there's a threat of violence at the end of that. So, but if violence doesn't matter because consciousness is non-local, then, you know, there's no way to control people anymore. And I'm not sure if that's the case or not, but I do think it's pretty clear to see that these sort of things are deliberately not supported. I mean, I think it was Hal Puthoff that said, there was more scientific evidence for the efficacy of, sorry, the more scientific evidence for the reality of psi phenomena than for the efficacy of ibuprofen, like in terms of peer reviewed studies, but it still hasn't broken through that cultural barrier. And, you know, I do think that is deliberate, which is why it's always really interesting whenever some sort of official governmental organization comes out and wants to talk about these things or allows these discussions to happen, because it's like, what's your other angle? You know, it's never, I don't think it's ever altruistic. Like, oh, we want to tell people about aliens. It's always like, what are you getting out of this slow release of information? Yeah.
Especially if it's not, they're not necessarily extraterrestrial and it is more of a conscious based phenomena, going on, because then you're not actually trying to hide something from somebody. You're trying to hide them from themselves, the truth of, mm-hmm. of what you are from yourself.
Well, you know, it's that Hindu idea of the veil of Maya being over people's eyes. And, yeah. You know, I think a lot of, you know, people who are into Ayurveda and a lot of these Eastern traditions that I can't quite wrap my head around this. That's my fault. But I think all of them pretty much are in consensus that even though the start and end times are not defined, that we all really are in the Kali Yuga, like the time that is like the worst, where everybody's obsessed with materialism, the spiritual is mocked, et cetera, et cetera. I think they're all pretty much in agreement that we're right in the throes of that right now, for sure. I'm always struck by my friend Mike Cleland talking to somebody who was expressing to them that he was having a bunch of these synchronicities, and he said, said, you know, I always thought that synchronicities were something someone would experience, you know, on a spiritual journey. And the person said to him, well, you know, researching UFOs is a spiritual journey, right? I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the old school cryptozoologists and ufologists would really, you know, barf in their handbags about this, me saying this, but I think that there is, belief is an important aspect to whatever this is. And I kind of wonder sometimes if the sort of being involved in researching these things isn't sort of a microcosm of what it means to have faith and personal gnosis. You know, I remember talking to Whitley Strieber about all this talk of disclosure around some of the To the Stars Academy stuff that was happening, and it was like, you know, we were talking about it, and like, you're not going to get disclosure from a government, you get disclosure from yourself. You know, I mean, you see enough evidence, enough personal experiences, enough of those emotions that we're talking about, enough of those personal truths that you get disclosure. You don't get some sort of disclosure handed to you, you know, on a silver platter. And I think that might be part of the reason that a lot of these phenomena are so resistant to being, you know, outed by the scientific method, is because they're just not, it's the wrong toolbox, right? You know, I'm I'm pro-science, anti-scientism, which is the idea that, you know, that basically the way the scientific establishment works, like, you know, certain things can't be true, therefore they aren't, you know, those sort of assumptions. And the idea that if it can't be reproduced in a laboratory setting, then it can never happen. There are a lot of assumptions within that I don't think quite work, that need a metaphysical shot in the arm. You know, I think that for years, centuries really, we waited for spirituality to catch up with science in terms of the things that it would accept in its enlightenment. But now I think we're kind of at the point where we're waiting for science to catch up to spirituality, really. Timothy Renner called me in September of 2018 and sort of wanted to do this book on high strangeness and Bigfoot. And we put it together and we realized that it was really big. You know, if we had released it as one book, I think it would have been a little bit intimidating to some people. So we ended up just figuring out sort of, there's a sort of dotted line demarcation between the two books, because there's a lot of, volume one is folklore, volume two is evidence. There's a lot of evidence in volume one and a lot of folklore in volume two. So it's a little bit of a misnomer, but we just said, okay, this is kind of roughly the halfway point where we can break this up. So we had the whole thing completed, and then basically we took the set of chapters that we had set aside for volume one, and Timothy and I worked on, mostly Timothy, honestly, but Timothy and I worked on, artwork and the layout and collecting, you know, blurbs and endorsements and stuff. And we got that set aside and then released that, and then waited, you know, a month or two, and then started the same process over again with volume two. So they ended up being released in May and December of last year. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it's fantastically researched, the work you've put into it. I mean, if it's only 2 years worth of work, then you need to more credit than you've already had for it, because the groundwork in it is it's meticulous. It's very thorough in terms of the work, in terms of the referencing, in terms of
I think Timothy would agree with this too. Like, yeah, that's that much work, but also, you know, you start writing books years before you start writing the book, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that you sort of start to work out, and things where you're like, I'm pretty sure I can find some evidence to support this idea because it's so congruent with everything. But I really, really do appreciate that. I'm very,
I have a lovely quote here from Greg Newkirk that I think is on your Amazon site, that says that the book, I think the first one, is posed to do for Bigfoot what Passport to Magonia did for UFOs, which is
Greg can say that and you can say that, but I've been told by my friend Greg Bishop that I can't say that, because I can't invoke Valet's name in comparison to anything I do, which is really what I would agree with. I would say that there are definitely the influences of Valet are really all over this. And you know, you could probably do Passport to Magonia for ghosts and Passport to Magonia for Nessie and, you know, all these things, because there are so many congruencies between these different, apparently at first glance, disparate bodies of folklore. I'm quite proud of what Timothy put together. And in terms of how it turned out, you know, I've said this before, my real deficit is in field work, because I don't really have a network. I was actually, humorously enough, before COVID started hitting, I was actually starting to look to get back into doing field work again. And now everybody's kind of weird about hanging out together. So hopefully after we maintain some degree of normalcy, if/when that happens, I can get back into field work. But part of the reason I think that volumes one and two have been so warmly received is that Timothy's approach complements mine very well, because Timothy has a lot of field experience as well, and a lot of interviewing witnesses. You know, I'm the kind of person who I think my strengths are in tracking down sources and, you know, literally sitting down with 70 years of MUFON journals and meticulously searching through them. But I think Tim's real strength is in that field research experience that he has. Not that he can't do what I do as well. He does that quite well as well. But I think it really sort of comes together quite nicely in terms of this boots on the ground and a little bit more of an academic approach as well.
There are many signs or clues that there is more to the creature we know as Bigfoot than him being a terrestrial, as yet uncategorized, relic hominid. There are tales of him materializing from nowhere, and of him vanishing as quickly and mysteriously. Many on his trail have chased him through the woods to a point where he cannot escape, only for him to turn behind a tree or rock and seemingly vanish from existence. There are countless tales of him being seen in close proximity to UFOs, often the sightings of the two phenomena happening within moments of each other, and a few rarer claims of the two actually interacting. But a common experience when one is tracking the wild man is the apparent crossover between Bigfoot or Sasquatch and what can only really be described as technology. Less known in cases of the Yeti, Almasti, or Yeren, the creatures who roam the woodlands of North America have been spotted holding orbs of all description, or surrounded by tiny lights, or emanating such lights from himself. There is video evidence aplenty of unexplained lights in the forests, below the tree line where there should be no light, moving around in the trees. They aren't fireflies, they aren't lost hikers, they aren't aircraft or distant roads or towns. It would appear that that primeval creature who lives in caves and communicates with woodnocks has indeed more tricks up his sleeve than we understand.
There does seem to be more of a hand-in-glove relationship between Bigfoot and some sort of apparent technology in North America as opposed to its worldwide analogs. I think that I kind of want to step back and sort of have us define technology first too, though. I mean, I think technology, my good friend Red Pill Junkie made this mention that, you know, I think ayahuasca is technology, you know. I think that magic even might be some sort of technology in terms of the way that we interface with it. But I'm not sure in terms of like the technical version that we think of technology, how often that's the case. I mean, it's that Arthur C. Clarke thing again, right? You know, any significantly advanced technology will appear as magic, but guess what? You know, art, you can flip that on its head too, and any sort of magic will appear to be significantly advanced technology. The lights are something that, the lights and the UFOs, or putting those two things together, structured craft versus just lights, are something that I think really are akin to the way that, again, to bring up Mike Cleland, talks about the way that ufologists will talk about synchronicities. Like, you get everybody's spoken at the conference and you get them back to the bar and you get a couple of drinks into them, and then they start talking about all the crazy synchronicities that they've had while researching UFOs, right? And I've got the impression from several people that I've talked to, because I'm not as entrenched in the Bigfoot community, but I've gotten the impression from several people that I've talked to, several friends of mine, that it's the exact same thing with the lights in Bigfoot. You know, get everybody a little bit loosened up, and then they start to talk about see these lights all the time back in here, and, you know, really shouldn't be able to. I've hypothesized that, you know, the lights might be the purest form of whatever the supernatural is, you know. that might be like, if you think about in terms of like video game terms, like that's the unskinned version of it, like that's the texture's missing, right? The Bigfoot fairy alien texture is missing from that. An aspect that I found really interesting regarding technology, though, is belts and Bigfoot. And I say belts specifically, you know, there are actually no shortage of stories where Bigfoot is seen wearing clothing. And even more commonly than just full clothing, which is surprisingly not that hard to find, there are stories of Bigfoot wearing belts. And sometimes these are, you know, loincloths and things like that. But sometimes they are you know, built with technology on it, like a little box with some glowing blue lights or something, which is just the most bizarre thing. Maybe ties into the idea that Bigfoot can cloak. You know, I'm not of the persuasion that Bigfoot are extraterrestrials that have cloaking technology. I think that's, we're dealing with something a little bit more literally supernatural, paranormal here. But it's interesting to me that if you look at the number of Bigfoot accounts where Bigfoot's wearing some sort of belt, either this highly technological belt or like, you know, a loincloth or some sort of just simple, you know, crude leather belt around its waist. If you look at those stories and you take a look at the means by which people were allegedly transforming into werewolves in, you know, the Middle Ages and whatnot, it was often facilitated by a girdle, you know, girdle of wolf skin that was given to someone by a witch. And I know some people might think that the Bigfoot werewolf comparison is sort of a long bow to draw, but I mean, in terms of the archetype they fulfill, that sort of wild man archetype, it's really kind of one and the same. To say nothing of the fact that there's a longstanding association here in the States of Bigfoot with Dogman, you know. So I don't think that there's, you know, a literal half man, half dog werewolf and, you know, a half man, half ape battling it out. But some people do think that that's the case. But I think that these are both sort of scratching that archetypal itch that we all have of the wild man. And it's interesting that that belt motif will sort of appear again on a half human, half animal, you know, being. I think it's really interesting.
In summary of all your work and your life so far, and your life within this research so far, what have been the moments, or even just the moment, where your beliefs have been changed the most?
Well, you know, I do think so. I'm not a huge experiencer, but I think the personal experience is something that really gets you to that moment where you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, right? Like that's the thing that really will push you over the edge. For the most part, I've sort of, you know, Goldilocks my way here in terms of finding things interesting and finding a lot of these stories compelling and a lot of these similarities compelling. But so this funny thing happens, right? If you have a genuinely anomalous experience, it'll happen, and it's wild, and it's, you know, life-changing, and it's in the moment, but then you get some distance from it and it starts to feel a little passe. You know, it's like, did I really see that? Did I really experience that? Well, it could have been that. You start second guessing yourself when you realize, you know, rationally remembering back to that moment, that there's no way that you could have mistaken it for what it was. And I guess that moment for me really does have to be back in 2008. I went with a girlfriend to Waverly Hills Sanitarium, which is in Louisville, Kentucky, just over the river from Ohio. Plenty of lore that you can read about this place. I wasn't really aware of much of any of it. Again, very just tangentially and just interested in all this stuff, right? Very passively, you know, interested in this stuff. But she was into ghost hunting. She had some friends, and I was like, this sounds like fun.
To give you an indication, it's well known even over here. So
okay, well there you go. So, there you go. So I didn't like I said, I kind of went in a little bit blind, I guess. I just thought it was going to be like, you know, we're going to hear some voices and it was going to be like on the TV shows. And I'm sure that there are plenty of people who've had some experiences that are a lot more dramatic. But this was my moment that was really dramatic for me. A couple years earlier, I had seen what I think is probably the ghost of a young Confederate boy here at a Civil War site in the States. But it was one of those things where it might have been a kid that was dressed up. I don't know. You know, it wasn't like that moment where you're like, no, this is exactly what I saw. So we went to Waverly, and there were odd things on and off all night. But the two things that really, really were my you know, Saul on the road to Damascus moments, I guess, where, you know, Waverly sort of shaped like a big wide U, and there was one floor that we were on where every time we would get just before the turn of the corner, it was like somebody had a television on the other around the corner. So it was that sort of like soft blue glow would be on, sort of flicker and move, and you could turn the corner and there'd be nothing there. So that's unambiguous, you know, and there's three of us together in our little pod that we were in. That's unambiguous. But I was sort of starting to feel spooked, and I was, you know, doing my sassy Hellboy routine, right? You know, sort of as a defense mechanism. And we were on another floor at this point. And I get to the stairwell door, and this door goes from being completely shut. We're about, you know, a meter away, right? I'm about a meter away from the door. Goes from being completely shut to slamming open so hard that it hits the wall. Right. So it's like somebody, it could not have opened more forcefully if someone was standing on the other side and just kicked that door in with all their strength. And, you know, I think about, it's almost as if that moment wasn't as startling as like the ride home and laying down to go to bed at, you know, 7 a.m. to try to get some sleep. Those were the moments, the ride home and laying down to go to bed. Those were the moments where I was like, oh, heck, I'll keep it PG. Yeah, this is real, and you can seek it out and you can find it. And the reason that a lot of people don't think it's real is because they are either not open to it or they are secretly scared of not finding. But like, if you try hard enough, you can sort of force whatever this is his hand. And no, this is these things are absolutely real. I brought up that sort of anecdote about, or that sort of insight about talking yourself out of it years down the line, because I've had my parents bring it up in conversation with other people, and I'm always like, don't worry, it was nothing. It was fine. You know, it was no big deal. But I think about how that was just, I was just shell shocked. I think it just took me some time to process it. And obviously it's not as, you know, as dramatic as being an alien abductee or something, but it was pretty dramatic. Now, you know, since then I haven't had a lot of stuff happen really at all. But that was the moment when I was like, okay, this, you know, the stuff, there's some real legitimacy to this stuff. And I kind of go back and forth on whether I want more of that in my life or not. You know, I have two-year-old sons, twins, and, you know, part of me is kind of like, I shouldn't really try to get involved in this until they're maybe a little bit older, because I just don't want that sort of influence in my life. But I do have a real...
It does change everything. I have
a
three-year-old, and my youngest is actually two tomorrow. He's two in about an hour and a half.
Oh, nice.
And so, yeah, I had it. As I started really going through the previous season of this, more and more little odd things that were probably just cropping up in my own psyche, but little odd. My three-year-old, the oldest, he's three and a half-ish, said he saw some odd little things that I'm almost certain are just in his little mind. But they just seemed to be increasing more and more the more I started to do it. And I took a break for 4 months or so, and I was never supposed to come back with a new season. This was just supposed to continue on as one thing. And in the end, I just stepped away and gave it a break, because I kind of felt the same, that I have, like you, since I was a little boy, really been fascinated. I wish I could see a ghost. I wish I could see a UFO. And then you realize, yeah, but not in my house, and not when I'm with my kids, and not, you know.
Yeah, everybody's
home. And actually, yeah, there's some mitigating kind of factors there that,
you know, at 3 p.m. everybody's all for seeing a gray alien walk by their window outside, but you transpose that to 3 a.m. and man, it's a different story. You know, it really is. The rubber meets the road to a degree. And I think that, I mean, I have seen enough people get involved in this, and it's just eaten them away parasitically, you know. I think a lot of that is the paranormal specifically, but I think a lot of it's just, you know, conspiracy culture too. I've had some family members who have just started to go down the rabbit hole, and I'm like, can you just pump the brakes a little bit on some of this stuff, because I've seen it happen too many times, and that's why I'm very grateful, as we were talking about before the show, that I do have music to distract me sometimes from this, because yeah. it is very, very alluring. We kind of had a little rash of poltergeist activity here in the house. And when we talked about it the next day, it was never a big deal. But when it was happening at night, it's like, this is kind of weird. So our sons have a habit of rocking their cribs, right? So they'll, you know, we have them secured, but sometimes they'll make these thumping noises, right? And we kept on noticing, you know, as we go to bed, these thumping noises would happen pretty regularly. And we just always assumed it was the boys until one night, my wife looked on the baby monitor and nobody's moving. And we still get this, you know, this repetitive thumping at night. And so, you know, we're kind of like, well, maybe it's, you know, a pipe or this or that or the other. Only could hear it in our bedroom. She had some relatives come over for Thanksgiving. None of them could hear it. This was all around that time frame. And so we kept on getting this thumping at night. And I'm kind of looking at this with my side eye, like, is this a thing or not? And this, you know, continues, not really any rhyme or reason, but it was the sort of thing where we'd go to bed and we'd hear a series of knocks / thumps about four times before we'd finally end up going to bed. You know, and sometimes you'd hear it and you just sort of sit up and just wait for it to happen again. So one night Sarah can't sleep, and she hears it again. And so she goes into the hallway and sits on the stairs and is listening for it. And according to her, it went from the series of thumps to sounding like someone was trying to kick the door of the house in. That sort of a sound. It wasn't coming from the door, but it had that sort of, like, you know, idea of someone kicking a wall or something, right? A lot more aggressive, a lot more ferocious, a lot more sustained. Now, this same night, I had a dream. And in this dream, I'm upstairs at my folks' place, and I'm in their kitchen. And there's this, like, 8-foot-tall black dude beside me. And I say to him in the dream, I say, oh, okay, this is great. We're here. We're in the dream. I can finally talk to you. What do you want? And it's this 8-foot-tall black dude says to me, my name is Shibalba, and I want black licorice, right? So I wake up the next morning, and, you know, I'm well-versed enough in folklore. I'm like, why do you say his name is Shibalba, which is the Mayan, I think it's the Mayan underworld, Aztec or Mayan, but I'm pretty sure it's the Mayan underworld. Why would he say his name is Shibalba? And I'm like, well, now that I think about it, spirits never give you their names, because if you have their name, you have power over them. So I'm like, okay, that makes sense. And then there's this black licorice request. I'm like, what the heck is going on? Should I try this or not? Because I'm sitting there going, being like, if I was reading about this in my research, I'd think the person was an idiot if they didn't just go out and get some licorice, right? So I tell my wife this. She's really hesitant/resistant to doing anything like that, because she doesn't want to admit that this is what we're dealing with. Has an exterminator come out. Guy looks, he's like, not only is it not coming from a rodent, there's like no signs of rodent activity anywhere in the spaces of your house. And not, it didn't ever sound like a rodent anyway, right? Rodents don't go thump 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 like that. So my wife just finally says, fine, get the black licorice. And in my dream, it had showed me a space at my parents' place in their kitchen that was similar to a space that we had. So I put up some black licorice there, and didn't happen again. Now, of course, after like the third day of putting licorice up there, I'm like, okay, listen, this is what we did. I don't want to have to keep on buying licorice, and I just tossed it out. But so, but there's another angle to this that isn't just the, you know, the spirit angle. That there's another angle to it that might be like the actual like textbook's poltergeist definition, right? The idea that it might be some sort of latent psi power. There was one of these nights, not the night where she heard the scuffling sound, but the scuffling kicking sound, but another night where she was awake and listening to these thumps. And she found out later that that both of her sisters and one of her cousins were all awake at the same time. And that was the same time that her grandmother died. So four of the six granddaughters were all awake at the same time. And I kind of think that...
Very interesting.
Yeah, there might be some sort of latent...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's really a sort of like fits in that classic latent poltergeist with a little bit of, you know, death premonition thrown in there too. So I kind of wonder if it wasn't coming from her. So I guess I'm married to an 8-foot-tall black guy or something. although in the dream this you know Shibalbo character was constantly transforming back between that and like this, you know, cute petite girl. So
did licorice, side note, whether it's something you ever considered, was licorice
I despise licorice,
but was licorice something that they had in Mayan culture?
Is
there a connection, or am I plucking at straws?
I'm not sure. That's a great question. I did go on and see that there's a couple of, depending on your practice, there are a couple of binding spells and grigu bags and stuff like that that use licorice. But I never really looked into the Mayan licorice connection, and I can't believe I didn't even put that together until now. So sometime probably in May. This is all real fluid right now, but sometime in May, a collection of essays will be coming out that I am the editor of and also a contributor to. And it's all about fairy films, but it's not necessarily about fairies on film. It's also about like looking at other films that don't have anything to do with fairies through that fairy lens. So, you know, about half of them are explicitly fairy films, and the other half are kind of looking like at Rocky Horror Picture Show as a fairy film or something like that. So looking forward to that coming out. That'll be coming out on August, but through August Night Press. And then I am working on currently the death book, I guess, is what you call it. So I've been fascinated for years by what Ann Streber, wife of Whitley Streber, once told him. They were getting all these letters about people's experiences, and she started noticing this trend, and she looks at him and goes, "Whitley, this has something to do with what we call death." And you know, every time I say that quote, I get chills. So I'm going in there and I'm trying to pull it apart, and I've kind of found some interesting stuff. So it's looking at paranormal entities through the lenses of psychopomps, which are like, you know, Hermes, Anubis, the Grim Reaper, these characters that carry you across the other side. Psychopomps, multiple selves, ancestors and the dead. And I know this don't necessarily sound like they're connected, but especially the multiple selves bit, but they are. Again, you end up tripping into an entire another section when you're trying to address one thing versus the other. So I'm starting to work on that. I've got maybe like a morning of research, and then I get to start actually writing that in earnest this week. So I'm excited and terrified. It's a big boy. I think my outline right now is 270 pages. So we'll see what happens. I'm going to need a good editor, for sure.
Joshua, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk with us. Absolute joy to hear about your work. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us tonight.
You're absolutely welcome. It was a lot of fun.
Brilliant. Take care.
Thanks.
Peer Beyond the Veil has been written and presented by myself, Mark Watson, as part of the Fearscape Media Network. Music and soundtracks are credited and licensed to Purple Planet and to Kevin MacLeod, licensed under Creative Commons. All rights are reserved by our parent company, MLW Publishing. You can follow us at facebook.com/peerbeyondtheveil or on Twitter at peerbeyondtheveil or at peerbeyond2020. Please click the like and subscribe buttons when you see them, most importantly, wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps us to attract the attention we need to keep the show going, to get the guests that you all want to hear from, and to help more and more people